Welcome back to Curated Advice on Better Living. And now your host, Khaled Sultan.
I'm going to start by asking you to introduce yourself, because I'm sure you can do a better job at that than me.
Okay. I'm Jim Green. Worked for NASA for over 40 years.
All right. And what did you do at NASA?
Oh, man, you name it. You know, I started out as a scientist in 1980. Went from a scientist to managing a branch, which is a group, and then a division, which is even a bigger group, you know, and then got involved in making satellites and building instruments, and then ended up down at NASA headquarters. And for 12 years, I managed the planetary program.
And what's the planetary program?
Well, all the planetary probes that are running around the solar system are managed out of NASA headquarters, and I was the division director. I was responsible for them. During that time period from 2006 to 2018, I was involved in at least 20 missions, maybe more.
For people that don't know, what is a NASA mission consist of?
Well, that would be, each mission would be a spacecraft or a rover.
Okay.
So spacecraft have destinations, you know, they fly by planets, they orbit planets, then take rovers, and then those rovers land, rove, and sometimes even return samples. The last thing I did from 2018 to 2022, just a matter of a handful of months ago, was be the NASA chief scientist.
And what was that like?
Well, that was a blast. Yeah. I mean, I've always had fun in everything I do. I really loved everything that NASA's doing. So I loved astrophysics and planetary science and heliophysics.
I can hear the love in your voice.
And earth science. I mean, all the kind of things that NASA does, building missions, going to places, analyzing data, doing scientific results, you know, that's the key thing. You have to make something happen.
You know, what got you into this? I mean, how did you... What was your gravity assist? There you go. Can you explain what gravity assist is for the people?
Yeah, gravity assist is a planetary term where as you go to a very large planet, that planet pulls you in. Okay.
So there's something about that planet.
Yeah. So it's big gravity. Okay. And the assist part is when you make a small deviation, go around the planet, and then go in a completely different direction. You're using that planet to really give you a slingshot to another destination.
Okay. So then let me rephrase the question. What was your gravity assist that made you believe that it's possible to pursue something like this, especially back then, that you could pursue a career in space?
Yeah. So I had several gravity assists. My first one was my high school chemistry teacher, who ended up managing a optical telescope, an observatory. There was a rather big telescope. It was a 12-inch Alvin Clark refractor, just a beautiful telescope.
And this was when?
Oh, this was 1968.
Wow, okay.
In high school. You know, before the Apollos landed, you know, Apollo astronauts landed on the moon. You know, and so he taught astronomy after school. We couldn't take it during the school day. We had to take it after school. So it was about 20 of us that did that. And I really loved it, you know, and I did a lot of work with the telescope, took a lot of pictures, built some instruments to take pictures with the telescope. And then I developed them, learned how to develop, and then I would actually get some things published in a magazine called Sky and Telescope. So as I was going through my high school career, you know, with these exciting things going on, several things were around me, like the TV show Star Trek, you know, the original one, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock or Dr. Spock.
Right.
And
was there a lot of movies or television shows or science fiction about space at the time?
Yes, of course. 2001, A Space Odyssey was one of these mind-blowing things.
Yeah. You know, I love that
in
movie.
In 1968. Yeah, it is.
It's still mind-blowing today.
It's still mind-blowing today. It really holds up well. It does. You're right. And then the Apollo astronauts started landing. So space was all around me. And so when I went to the University of Iowa, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and that is to get involved in space. And then my next gravity assist was with my first astronomy teacher at the University of Iowa, who was James Van Allen. And James Van Allen is NASA's first scientist, successful scientist, who had an experiment on Explorer 1 and discovered the high-energy radiation belts around the Earth, which we call today the Van Allen radiation belts. And he was spectacular. So, I mean, I really learned how to do research with him. I really learned what the University of Iowa was doing. They were building instruments. And so I thought, hey, you know, rather than observing on the ground with telescopes, I can use spacecraft and observe the things I wanted to
do. So at the time, there was no direct university path to a career in space. But you were pursuing interests like astronomy, things related to space.
It started out that way, but by the time I was at Iowa, it was clear that they had a program that you get an undergraduate degree in astronomy, and then you get a master's in physics, and then a PhD in space physics.
Okay, so there was an academic route.
Yes, it was a path. Yeah, it was. It probably was the first university, you know, in the United States to really offer that capability.
And then from then on, you know, into NASA, was there like an application process? Or did they come after you and say, you know, you're a genius, we need you on board?
Well, because I was at the University of Iowa, they, you know, said, you're going to do research, which I dearly loved, mm-hmm. And so I'd written several scientific papers before I got my PhD. I'd gone to, 15 or more conferences, giving talks. So when I left the University of Iowa, I actually was pretty well known. And I got 5 job offers in 1980.
Wow.
When it was very difficult for some graduate students to even get one. Yeah, so it was a wonderful time. You know, I was indeed sought out, and I decided I'm going to take a civil servant position at the Marshall Space Flight Center, which I did. So I started right out working for NASA.
You were the first person to catch a hacker on the NASA network, is that correct?
Correct. So you first have to invent the network.
Right.
And I did that.
And this was when?
In 1980. Yeah. So 1980.
They had internet in 1980?
We created it.
Okay.
The NASA private network. So I put together a NASA private network. You know, at the time, the only other big network was done by the Department of Defense called ARPANET, and in looking at how they structured it and how they were putting it together, it was way too expensive. So I figured out a way to do it that was much cheaper, and then started linking a lot of my friends who were scientists also at various institutions. And by the end of 1980, we were doing email and phone, and you know, were you over the computer talking to somebody, you know, like the instant messaging we do today. That was done in 1980, you know, and then I would log on computers and run various jobs and get plot files and send those files back to me, which is what we do routinely. You know, right now you get a ebook and you download it, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that contains pictures in it and everything else. And we were doing that in 1980, generating data and downloading it.
You were ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
So how did this whole, you know, wild story of catching a hacker happen?
Well, you know, it turns out I was in an area where we had quite a few computers that were on the network, and I could easily see who was on each computer. It was a little capability, you could say, show users and point to a computer. And so I did that because I did a lot of computer modeling. One of my things that I did was ray tracing, we call it, which is showing how light moves in anisotropic media. You know, that's kind of obscure, but that was very important back then. And I needed a lot of computing time, so I would just say show users on a particular computer and see who's on it. And then if there wasn't too many people on it, I could, you know, log on, download my program, run the program, take a bunch of CPU cycles, get my data back, you know, and that was just great. That was perfect way to go. But one of the computers that I was looking at was managed by an individual who I knew real well, and she, the administrator of the computer, was on vacation in the Bahamas. Now, when she left, she said, you know, don't plan on, you know, even getting a postcard from me. I'm gone, man.
Yeah, I'm on vacation.
I'm on vacation, and that's the end of that. And so so when I logged on and saw that her account was active, I thought, ooh, that's pretty weird.
She's a workaholic.
No, she's not. And I knew that, too. If it was me, see, it would have been, okay, yeah, that is me.
Yeah.
But so I knew that wasn't right. And after watching him a while, it was clear that it wasn't her. And so I went to...
How did you determine that it wasn't her?
What happens is to get on the computer, you have to be either on the network or dial into the computer. And so the way that account was active was it was dialed into the computer. And so I can tell that the number that they were coming from wasn't the Bahamas. So I turned it over to communications at Marshall Space Flight Center, where I was at, and they called the FBI. And the FBI traced the line and got these four high school kids.
High school kids?
They were high school kids.
In the U.S.?
Yeah.
How did they figure that out?
They were even in the town I was in, Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay. Wow. I mean, how did they figure out how to do that?
Because they went to a school that had a similar machine. And when they saw the representative from that company come out to upgrade the machine, put in new patches, he would always log on to a service account. It was called the field service account. And so they've saw that when he logs in, the username is field service and the password was field service, which is crazy. You don't do that kind of stuff, okay? Password protection is critical. And that gave anybody logging into that account complete administration capability. You can do anything you want. You create accounts, you can get rid of accounts, you can load in patches. And, of course, that's what they did is they found one of these computers on the network by dialing phone numbers and seeing if you hear a modem, which is a device that allowed you to go from a phone call to a computer prompt. And that was the right computer, so, and they just broke into it.
We're talking to the gentleman who is the first person from NASA to catch the first hacker.
Yes, I know.
Wow, that's a crazy story.
Yeah. Well, it gets even more interesting when it hit national news. So Peter Jennings in the United States, a really big newscaster, Walter Cronkite, and others that are well known. He talked about it on the news, and the next day I was in the center director's office trying to explain why we needed to keep this computer network, not destroy it like he would like to, And so he said, okay, you can keep it, but you better start securing it. And that's when I put in NASA's first security group.
Interesting.
And then we started catching hackers.
Okay.
So in a matter of, maybe 10 years, we caught 36 hackers.
36 hackers.
Yeah.
Wow. I wonder what they're after.
Well, at that time, it was mostly playing around.
Yeah.
It really wasn't malicious.
So listen, I know we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to get straight into the big questions. Ooh. When are we going to live on Mars or the moon? I know we've had this conversation and you said it would be the moon first. How realistic is this?
Oh, really realistic. I mean, we're going to, in the matter of a handful of years, 4 or 5 years, humans are going to be standing on the moon again. And the first big mission that tests the capability go do just exactly that is called Artemis 1. And we've tried to launch it now a couple times. There's been a couple problems. It's a very complex system, but it's
to get another man on the moon.
Yeah. And, right. Well, we're going to put the first woman on the moon. That's the next person to walk on the moon will be a woman.
But the objective is what? To have people live on the moon?
Yes. We're going to do something very different.
How habitable is the moon in the first place?
Well, you have two choices. One, bring everything and create habitats, bring everything including habitats, and then just live in those and work on the moon.
And like a dome, an isolated?
Yeah, whatever you could bring. Or you figure out how to use the resources on the moon and build habitats.
What resources are on the moon?
The moon's got all kinds of stuff. The moon actually is very identical to the Earth. They were created pretty much at the same time. They have similar chemistry. They have similar materials. In fact, we've even started, when the Apollo program brought back rocks and lunar soils, we've used some of those soils to even grow plants.
Really? So,
yeah. Yeah, just in the last year.
So you think it's possible to grow like crops like food on the moon?
Yes, but you use the resources by bringing it into a greenhouse. You don't. You're not going to grow it out in a space where there's no atmosphere. So the moon has no atmosphere.
Okay, so
that's a problem.
So how would that look like? Like if we were to have people living on the moon, a civilization on the moon, eventually they would be all living inside in these.
They would all be living inside. Yeah.
Okay.
So
we'd have to build on the moon first.
Right. So we're going to use, we're going to bring some things, but we're going to use a lot of resources that are there. And we can do that now better than we ever have before because we have capability to do what's called 3D printing, where you can take material and melt it and then reshape it and create a new structure. And that's our plan. We'll be doing a combination of building structures and bringing some of our own.
So, Dr. James, why the moon and not Mars? I know Elon Musk has this vision of, you know, creating a civilization on Mars, and some people have even signed up for that. Why moon versus Mars?
It's actually pretty easy to understand when you realize the moon's pretty close. Three days we're there. 3 days doesn't get you hardly near Mars at all. I mean, it takes 90 days minimum to get to Mars.
So why is he so fixated on Mars?
Well, you'd have to ask him.
Okay.
But Mars is more like Earth than any other planet.
Okay. And that might be it.
Yeah, that might be it. That might be it. And I know he wants to die on Mars, and that's fine. But indeed, we're going to go to the moon. We're going to learn to live and work on a planetary surface. And the moon is first. And once we know how to use the resources that are there, we're going to use some of the same basic ideas when we go to Mars. So we have to practice somewhere. And we have to, you know, perfect our capability and be able to go to an even more important place, which is Mars.
Okay. And so how soon will we have people, not the first, you know, not another man, sorry, or woman on the moon, but actually people living there, like starting a civilization?
Oh, that's a good question. Our plan, I would say in 100 years period, we would have tens, maybe hundreds of people that will have been on the moon living, working for shorter periods of time, shorter meaning weeks and months. Some maybe even starting to live there for years.
100 years.
Within 100 years. It's a long-term proposition.
So probably not in my lifetime.
Well, I don't know. In 100 years, medicine is going to change so much, you might be able to live to 150.
Maybe.
You're certainly not 50.
Yeah,
so
that's
true. You might be seeing all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, you will be.
Maybe I'll make it to the moon one day.
Yeah, well, I mean, just think back 100 years. You know, 100 years ago, we hadn't crossed the Atlantic. 100 years ago, we were just barely building planes that go a couple hundred miles an hour, and you know, and we use those in World War II, and they're biplanes, and or World War I, and then we didn't even have jets. You know, jets didn't come along until the mid 40s.
So, is there anything you would want people to know? You know, I mean, most people don't have as much knowledge about space, and you know, I mean, you of course have the space nerds and stuff. But is there something you want people to know when it comes to space?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
What would that be?
It turns out we need to be more space aware. The whole population on this globe needs to know the benefits of space. We do an enormous amount of things in space. In fact, I believe the human species cannot survive very long without utilizing space. From space, we see what's happening globally. You know, from space, a spacecraft can fly over a country and see how much is under cultivation. And right there, determine through the analysis of the data of that spacecraft, whether that country is going to import food or have enough to export it, okay?
From space.
Whether it's in a state or a country, you know, you name it, you know, in terms of managing water resources, in terms of looking at pollution, who's polluting, how to stop that, you know, be better stewards of the world. You have to first monitor it, and that's going to be done globally.
That's very interesting because some of the criticism that people have when it comes to space exploration is that, you know, look, they're spending all this money on exploring space, but, you know, there's climate change and there's so many problems here on Earth. But you're saying that actually that can help the planet, you know, by observing and noticing these patterns, we can actually help the planet.
So let's step back and say, how did we even realize the climate was changing? I mean, we've been predicting this for 20 years or more. Well, we figured it out because of Venus. The scientists that understood what was happening on Venus in the late 70s, early 80s, they took their computer codes once they realized Venus had a runaway greenhouse and brought them to Earth and then started getting Earth modeled completely and then changed the CO2 distribution a little bit. And the CO2, you know, it's funny in the sense that CO2, small amounts of CO2 rise the temperature enough that really affect water vapor. And water vapor is the greenhouse gas that we're really worried about. That's the most extensive greenhouse gas, which means it allows light to come in, heat the surface, which changes its wavelength, and then that new wavelength of light called infrared is not allowed to escape, and that's heat. And so that just means the heat in the atmosphere continues to rise because it's not allowed back out into space. So it's from the planetary science that we really know that humans are adding CO2 to the atmosphere, causing these changes to occur. We also from space recognize how our upper atmosphere, parts of it called the ozone, this is a very important layer, it's about 20 kilometers up, that's used to absorb ultraviolet light.
Right, the UV.
Yeah, the UV.
Which
causes skin cancer. Oh, and kills plants outright. I mean, you can't grow with intense UV, the kind of plants that we have here on Earth.
Growing up in New Zealand, and also I know it's like this in Australia, we've been told that, you know, our ozone is damaged, which is why we have high rates of skin cancer.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, of course. So what we recognized is the ozone was being deteriorated, and we didn't know how that was happening, except some of the Venus scientists said, well, ozone's being destroyed on Venus by chlorine. And then that got us onto the track of, well, chlorine may be doing it here. Ah, humans are generating a chemical called CFCs, chlorofluorocarbon, full of chlorine. That's the first C. Mm-hmm. And that's what's destroying the ozone. And once we determined that, then we created an international agreement to ban CFCs in the atmosphere. Now the ozone is starting to heal itself.
So what was the most memorable moment that you've had while working at NASA?
Oh, that's really easy. It's the flyby of Pluto by New Horizons, the landing of Curiosity on Mars, the landing of Perseverance on Mars, the exciting helicopter that we've gotten working on Mars, Cassini flying between the rings in the upper atmospheres, measuring the amount of ring material that's falling on the planet called ring rain, the Huygens probe that landed on Titan going through the atmosphere, and then the radar that we got on Cassini that found lakes of liquid on a surface of another body, and it's a moon of Saturn, and finding water in huge amounts on the north and south pole of the moon, not in water form, but in ice form. And I can go on for 10 more minutes talking about the most exciting moment.
It sounds like a very fulfilling and exciting career.
Oh, it's just been one thing after another. It's just been astounding.
Is there anything else you want people to know?
Yeah. Oh, there's a whole bunch of things.
Please.
So we talked about monitoring the Earth and understanding the average temperature of the Earth is changing. And we can only make that measurement from space. That's how we understand the average temperature is going up. You can't make that an average temperature measurement on the Earth because you can't put thermometers in the ocean or in the polar cap, but you can do that from space. But Earth science is not the only important thing. You know, we're in planetary science, we recognize our orbit around the sun is a terrible orbit to be in. If we could change it, we would, right? Because we have a lot of objects that cross our orbit that will eventually hit the Earth. As we go around, that will sweep them up, and those are called near-Earth objects. Near-Earth objects.
Not like asteroids.
Yeah, they're asteroids. They're thrown out of the asteroid belt by Jupiter, actually. That's where they're coming from. And then they get in an orbit that crosses our orbit, then that's a disaster.
How frequently do these hit our planet?
Well, we estimate everything from city killers to planet killers are out there, and there's about 60,000 of them that cross our orbit, and we're going to sweep them up, and it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when.
Right, and how come up until this point, none of them have, you know, hit a city and there's been a catastrophic impact?
So when you talk about catastrophic impacts, there's been a lot of catastrophic impacts that have occurred in ancient history. You can go back and...
Ice Age and...
All kinds of, you know, the dinosaurs died because of a catastrophic impact of an object that's 6 kilometers. Now, that was 68 million years ago, so that sounds like a long time. But there's been many smaller ones. But you have to recognize that that humans on this Earth has really only exploded in terms of their number, their concentration, their technologies, and their ability to stay and build a city because of the invention of agriculture only in the last 12,000 years. So even in that length of time, there's been a couple impacts that have occurred that are well known. In fact, just a couple years ago, we had one in Chelyabinsk, Russia, that thousands of people saw as this thing came in, exploded in the air, knocking out windows all over the place. And it actually was just a nitty-bitty thing. It wasn't very big at all. We're really concerned about this, and we have to defend the planet against these objects. So when I was head of planetary, we created a mission called DART, which is a double asteroid redirect test. That's an acronym, DART. And we launched it in November, and we're going to hit an asteroid in the end of September, September 26th.
This month?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're going to move it.
We're going to move it.
We're going to move it.
What are we hitting it with?
A spacecraft. We're going to get it moving as fast as we can, and we're going to hit it. And this object is 160 meters in diameter.
Do we know where exactly it's heading?
Yeah. It's a moon of a bigger asteroid.
Okay.
So we wanted to hit something and watch its orbit change, but not hit something and have it move its orbit and create a problem for the Earth. And so the best way to do it is to go to something that's orbiting something, hit it, so that just that orbit changes and it doesn't cause a hazard to the Earth. But allows us to make a measurement of how effective this concept of kinetic impactor really is.
So is this the first time we're testing this sort of, Earth defense system? Wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it really is.
Can you tell people when exactly this is going to happen?
Yeah, it's on Monday, the 26th of September, 7:33 p.m. East Coast time in the United States.
Okay, and is this
East Coast
this is
the United States
being launched from the
it's
U.S.?
It's already launched. It's on its
way. It's already launched. Okay.
Oh, yeah. We launched in November of last year.
And is this, I mean, if people look this up, is this public information?
Yeah,
DART.
D-A-R-T.
NASA DART. Google that.
NASA DART. Yeah, Google that. You bet. And indeed, it will be pretty spectacular. Now, 160 meters is a city killer. So if that hit Doha, it would be disaster. Everyone in Doha would be dead.
God forbid.
Yeah.
That sounds horrible.
It's terrible. So it's one of those that we think there's about 20,000 of them that cross our orbit. It's something that, you know, the Earth can't really stand having happen. Now, most of the Earth, 70% of the Earth is covered by water. So these things do hit water. And sometimes we know about it, sometimes we don't.
So there's a 70% probability that it will hit water.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big probability that it'll hit water.
Okay.
But we have to worry that it's going to hit land and hit land in an area like a city that would be just devastating. But even hitting water creates tsunamis, and that could be a disaster too. So.
Well, I hope the mission is successful.
Yeah, we do too.
Yeah.
We'll learn a lot by doing it. It'll be our main defense mechanism against a whole series of asteroids.
Now, I have to ask you this question. And I know we've discussed it off the record, but to your knowledge, is there any evidence that we have encountered UFOs?
Good question. UFOs are unidentified flying objects. That just means we don't know what they are.
Right.
But I think your real question is there life beyond Earth? Have we found evidence that life has sprung up on another planet, whether it's in our solar system or somewhere else?
I mean, it's hard to believe that there's no life beyond Earth.
Yeah. To me, I'll give you my honest opinion, and I think there is life out there. Right now, and NASA's looking for it, right now we haven't found the evidence that we need to declare that we have found life.
But you found some evidence that indicates.
Yeah, we have found a number of areas, in particular on Mars, that in the past was fantastic. Mars was a blue planet like the Earth at a time when life started on the Earth. So did it start on Mars? Mars went through climate change, rapid climate change. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we want to know is how and why that happened, because climate change is happening here. You know, so by looking at other planets, what we call comparative planetology, that really tells us a lot about the evolution of our own planet. That's also one of the reasons why it's important to go into space. So we need to defend ourselves against near-Earth objects. We need to study the evolution of the other planets in with respect to our own evolution. We need to heed the warnings of runaway greenhouse gases and effects that changed Venus, which are also a blue planet, for billions of years into the hot planet it is today.
You're saying the evidence that NASA has that indicates that there could have been life on Earth was the fact that Mars or Venus seemed to have at one point been a blue planet and might have had good conditions for another life form?
Yeah. Life could have actually come and gone on both planets. This solar system that we live in, the Earth, all the planets, and the sun, is 4.6 billion years old. We just talked about how humans have become more aware of their environment, actually, for the first time, began to be masters of the environment by starting to do agriculture. That's only 12,000 years. Mm. 12,000 years ago, agriculture started, allowing humans to then stay in a place and grow food, free up time for others to do a variety of work, and really create cities and societies and cultures. And, you know, that's such a small period of time. It's unbelievable.
Has NASA or any space institute encountered any extraterrestrials?
No.
Okay, so there's evidence to indicate that there is some life form out there.
There's evidence to indicate that there's environments where life, if it existed at that time, could have grown and survived and thrived. But of course, the evidence of that is hard to find because it's no longer habitable. You may not know this, but you know, 12,000 years ago, the Sahara Desert was the Garden of Eden. I mean, it wasn't like it is today. So the Earth constantly goes through a variety of climatic changes. 12,000 years ago, the North Polar Cap went through Canada into the upper part of the United States, and it's been receding ever since, leaving the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway and Hudson Bay. In Europe, it went down as far as into France, and as it receded, you know, it left the English Channel and many other bodies of water that you know so well today. That was 12,000 years ago, and the climatic patterns were very different than they are today. And that made the Sahara Desert a Garden of Eden. You know how we know this?
How?
There are rock paintings of prehistoric cultures, much like the cave paintings we hear so much about of ancient humans.
Hieroglyphics, right?
No, not hieroglyphics. That would be writing. But scenes of herding cattle, of wedding processions, of fishing, of catching crocodiles, all kinds of stuff, and these are on rocks, huge mountain cliffs and things, rock paintings done by these ancient people 12,000 years ago. Sicily frescoes. You know, Google it, take a look at them. They're beautiful.
Definitely. And speaking of ancient people, there's a lot of there's art, ancient carvings that indicate some human encounter with UFOs or some life out there.
Well, that's how you interpret them. But, you know, one could say Picasso must have been influenced by, something out of this world when he creatively gave impressions of different views and different art, that we know and love today, as the many of the artists go through various phases.
You know,
that doesn't mean they were influenced by aliens.
Okay,
is what I'm saying.
I believe that the Pentagon announced that they have encountered, I don't know if it was UFOs or
they call them something different.
Aerial phenomenon?
Or? Yeah, they call them unidentified. Wait a minute, they call them UAPs. Yeah, unidentified aerial phenomena.
Okay. And so, you know, you see all this, all these videos of, Navy pilots encountering what appears to be UFOs. And how do you explain that?
Okay. So you have to analyze the light that's coming through their camera systems to determine, is there any stray light? I mean, if you've ever done any photography and you get something that shines bright in a certain area and you move your camera and it sweeps across your lens, that doesn't mean it's a UFO, you know? So these are complicated systems and they must be examined appropriately. Now, that may be the case, may not be the case, but they have to be examined.
So you're saying it could be the systems, the instruments.
The internal optics.
In the aircraft that is flawed.
Right. Well, it's not necessarily flawed. It has stray light. Who knows? We have to study it. We don't know enough about them yet.
Right. So you're saying there isn't enough evidence.
But I have to tell you something.
Yeah. Please.
If I was an alien and I traveled across the universe.
Right.
Huge distances. I'm not going to pick out Navy planes and say, look at me, I'm flying by and I'll give you a smile. I'm going to make known that I'm here to meet another civilization. So to me, it's just kind of inconceivable that we get this tantalizing glimpse of what we think are aliens and claim they're aliens, when in reality, we could have 100 other explanations.
All right. I know you have a flight, so we'll have to wrap this up.
I have a plane to catch.
I have one question for you.
Okay.
What's your advice on how to live a better life?
Oh, that actually is pretty easy. I practice it, try to practice it every day. Haven't done so recently. And that is, I try to set aside 2 hours and read. You know, when I look at a book, I look at what it takes to write a book. And it takes a lot of work, a lot of, somebody's time and effort. You know, it's sort of like a mind melt. Whether they're writing about their experiences or they're talking about research they've done and history.
And you read
history a lot.
History, okay.
Yeah.
Read what's
interesting to you, you bet. I read science fiction, but I mostly read nonfiction. And so, when you think about what it takes to really write down what's happening experiences, by reading, you gain so much. Try it sometime.
I need to get back into reading.
Yeah, reading is the way to go.
Dr. James Green, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Curated Advice on Better Living. It's our passion to interview guests on their experiences to bring you different perspectives on personal development, on everything from healthy habits to mindset to relationships to functional movement and biohacking. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we hope you've gotten some information that can change your mindset. Make sure to like, rate, and review the show, and we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, we'll leave you with this from Bruce Lee.
Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.